So before we get going in that, I want to ask, who here has ever had a job where you had to take inventory? Wow, a lot more than I expected, actually. Inventory is just, it seems like a long and tedious and annoying and just a process. But for some reason, it's important, right? Taking inventory is important. It's important to your boss. It's important to the owner. It's important to you, as it makes sure you have everything you need to do in your job, whatever it is, whether it be working at McDonald's and you have enough fries, or working at the Apple store and making sure you have enough iPhones. It doesn't matter. Inventory is important. You got to have what you got to have in order to serve the people that you serve, right? So as a child, I grew up, my mother and father, they owned a convenience store / restaurant all combined into one building. And every year, on January 1st, without fail, my dad broke out a little a Mead college-ruled notebook, and he walked aisle by aisle through his store, and he took inventory of every single thing in the store. And that was important because we needed to know what the next year held. We needed to know what we had to do as a business. We needed to know the supplies we needed, the supplies we didn't need, the things that have been on the shelf for a year, the things that have been on the shelf for 5 years, you know, the things we needed to get rid of. We had to take inventory. So inventory was important. So why do I say all that? Well, if you look at 1 Kings chapter 7, and at first glance, if you read through it, it looks like a big inventory sheet. But what 1 Kings chapter 7 actually has is a lot more to unpack than just some inventory of a palace and some inventory of a temple. There's far more in those 51 verses than just an inventory of the things that Solomon had acquired, things that Solomon had built, things that his father David had accumulated that he would soon bring into the temple and things like that. So inventory is important, but on the surface, that's just the surface layer. There's always something underlying when you take inventory. So will you pray with me? Lord, I just pray that you would take this word and take your chapter and take these precious words and open up our hearts, open up our minds, open up everything that you would have for us, and show us what you need to tell us today and show us how to apply it to our lives. And I ask that you would be with us today and every day as we look through your word and we apply it to our lives and we go out about our days and everything that we do. Amen. So if you're there, if you're in 1 Kings chapter 7, I'm actually going to bounce back a few verses just to get a little bit of context. I'm going to start off actually in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 37, and read from there. So this is what it says. The foundation of the temple of the Lord was laid in the fourth year in the month of Ziv. In the 11th year, and in the month of Bul, the 8th month, the temple was finished. In all its details, according to its specifications, he, which is Solomon, who we're talking about, he had spent 7 years building it. And then it goes on into the beginning of building his palace. It took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete construction of his palace. He built the palace of the Forest of Lebanon, 100 cubits long, 50 wide, and 30 high, with four rows of cedar columns supporting trimmed cedar beams. It was roofed with cedar above the beams that rested on the columns, 45 beams, 15 to a row. Its windows were placed high in sets of three, facing each other. All the doorways had rectangular frames. They were in the front part in sets of three, facing each other. He had made a colonnade 50 cubits long and 30 wide. In front of it was a portico. And in front of that were pillars and overlapping and an overhanging roof, sorry. He built the throne hall, the hall of justice, where he was to judge, and he covered it with cedar from floor to ceiling. And the palace in which he was to live, set farther back, was of similar design. Solomon also made a palace like the hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had married. All these structures, from the outside to the great courtyard and from foundation to eaves, were made of blocks of high-grade stone cut to size, smooth on their inner and outer faces. The foundations were laid with large stones of good quality. Some measured 10 cubits and some 8. Above were higher-grade stones cut to size, cedar beams. The great courtyard was surrounded by a wall of 3 courses of dressed stone and 1 course of trimmed cedar beams, as was the inner courtyard of the temple of the Lord and the portico. Whew. We just took inventory of Solomon's whole palace. It seems like a lot of stuff and a lot of detail went into it, right? Talks about measurements, fine stones that were cut in such a way that their faces were of a fine nature. Cedar beams, cedar columns, all these things, right? It seems like Solomon had put great detail into it. And at first glance, you take a look at the very end of chapter 6, and it talks about, if you do the math, it took Solomon 7 years to build the temple. But then in the very first verse of chapter 7, it says it took him 13 years to build his palace. So what does that tell us about Solomon? Without knowing the context of what's actually happening, you would think, man, he spent half the time building the Lord's house as he did his own house. But in reality, the Lord's house, the temple that he built in a 7-year time period, was built with such zeal and excitement, and they were so motivated to get it done and get it done right, that it was done in a much faster fashion than when he built his own home, which was built at a much more leisurely pace of 13 years. So on the surface, not everything is always as it appears. Just like when you take inventory, it's not always as it appears. You know, if you just read that really quickly, you say, man, Solomon took twice as long to build his own house. He must have been so meticulous and so detailed and so everything about it. But the truth is, he was far more motivated to build the business, to build what it took to get God's temple done first. And then later on, he took care of his own home in a much more leisurely fashion. In the winter of 1983, I was 4 years old. And my family, like I said, had owned a business. And you can put it up there, Tracy, it's okay. My family owned a business, and this is a really old picture. So this was our family store. In the front was the convenience store. In the back, there was a restaurant. And upstairs, if you see that porch upstairs, that's our apartment. That whole upstairs was where we lived. And in the winter of 1983, I had a habit of waking up sometime in the morning and waking my mother up, as most young children do. They just love to either get in bed with mom or wake her up, tell her, got to go to the bathroom, whatever. I don't remember what exactly my circumstance was, but I had a habit of waking up very early. And a little backstory to that is I come from a family of 6, but I don't come from a family of 6 very close children. I come from a family of 6 where my 4 oldest siblings were born very close together, and then my closest in age brother was born 7 years after my sister, so he was the 5th child. And then I was born 8 years after my brother. So in that, from the first 4, the youngest of them, I was a 15-year gap, almost 16-year gap, actually. So I was very much younger than my siblings, and I came along probably what you could say a little unexpected. I wasn't exactly probably planned. I've never actually asked the question, but it's probably a good assumption to make that I was not planned 15 years later after some of my siblings. So anyways, so I was very young, we were living upstairs, and it was the winter of 83, and it just so happened one morning I woke up, just like I normally did. But the problem that morning was I couldn't breathe. So I went into my mom's room, and I said, "Mom, I can't breathe." And so she woke up, and immediately she realized that the house was on fire. The business was on fire. So my father took me out, and before he had a chance to even go back up and get my mom and dad, because my mom was waking up my brother, before they had a chance to go back up and get him, or my dad had a chance to go back up and get them, the flames were so bad that he couldn't get back in the building. So from that top porch up there, my mom and my brother stood and had to figure out a way to get out. It's not a sad story. My mom and my brother actually jumped off that porch down onto the ground, actually onto a car, so not quite to the ground, and they made it through the fire. But the next picture is what it looked like after. So I show you all this and I tell you all this because I believe it has some good real life, if you will, or modern life application to this story. What happened next was, obviously, they demolished the building, and we had to go find a place to live for a little while. It was quite a blessing. We lived with a blind woman, so my parents took care of this blind woman while we searched for a new home and built a new home. But I tell you this because they leveled this thing to its foundation. The foundation still ended up being good, and my father and contractors, and actually we lived out in the middle of nowhere in New York, so there was a lot of Amish, so we had a lot of good labor. We rebuilt the store and the restaurant in a matter of about a year's time, and the business was back in business. So my father invested in what he knew had to be done, and he got it done quickly, and he got it done right, so that the family could get back in business and we could carry on. So I tell you that because it's, in my mind, it's similar to Solomon. Solomon first invested in the business of Israel, which was God, right? Or which still is God. Solomon invested, he got the best men, they quarried the best stones and rocks, and they brought them all, and they built the temple, and they built it fast, and they built it right, so that the business of God could be done. So we lived in the new store and the new restaurant for quite a while. And actually, the funniest thing is we lived in a 400 square foot apartment. This sanctuary right here is far bigger than the apartment I grew up in. It was probably more like that area over there. There was two 10 by 10 bedrooms, a living room, and because we had a restaurant, that was our kitchen. We grew up there. But so my dad, he built the store and he built the restaurant and he got us all back in business. And a few years down the road, my dad had decided to finally build my mom her dream home. And it wouldn't be what I would call a dream home, but it's their dream home and it's where they always wanted to live. My dad owns some land down on this creek and my dad loves to fish. So that was great for him because they built the house literally on the creek, and he just sits on his porch and he fishes and he loves it. And I got a picture here. You probably can't really see it, but that creek way back in there, there's a house. And this creek. The funny thing is, this creek or crick, depending on what part of the country you come from, and I go back and forth. So I apologize for that. You see, there's this little dirt road that runs back to it. And this is their dream home, mind you, a beautiful home. But it took them years to complete. Like, he literally poured the pillars, and they sat for a year. Because I'm not even joking, the front porch is on the creek. And every year, without fail, that creek floods over that road. The house was completed sometime in my junior year of high school, senior year of high school, and we had a rowboat, and I used to have to row out to the main road to catch the bus. I'm not even joking. You think it's funny, and it was funny at the time, but my father was very smart about it. The house is exactly level with the main road, which is a bridge that goes over this creek, is exactly level with that bridge. And that bridge is never flooded. So he built it. He had it built exactly level with that bridge. But it took them years to complete this. And this house is beautiful. I would never live there, but it is a beautiful home. Hardwood floors that my dad cut the wood, nice pine ceilings, big open floor plan, all this stuff. None of that's important. What's important is that my dad and my brother and a few others that helped him focused on building this house, my dad's palace, my mom's dream home. It took them years to build it. He wasn't so focused on his own comfort as he was making sure he took care of the family and took care of the family business. Same way Solomon was. He made sure he took care of the family business, have you? You know, the family business was God, right? His son, or his father David, was a man after God's own heart, and he was a man that was deeply engaged with God. So he made sure that he built that temple first, and he got it done, and he got it done quickly. And then he spent twice the amount of time building his own home. And his home is beautiful, no doubt about it. So, I tell you this because I want to talk about priorities. Priorities of Solomon were to get the temple done, then build a palace for himself, his wife, the Pharaoh's daughter, and then also a place to do judgment and things of that nature, and the kingly things that he needs to do. And priorities often dictate our actions at the moment. At the moment, my priorities are taking care of my family. I have a job. I have a house, vehicles we transport everybody around in. I have future priorities, too. My parents are, as I said, I kind of came along late in life. So my parents are getting up there in age, and I have priorities of heading back to New York and spending some time with them as they're getting older. And I have a priority of a goal that I want to run a marathon. And foolishly enough, I signed up for one. Listen, I may be chubby, but I can actually run. Anyways, so, I have priorities there, too, priorities with training. I have this little app that says, hey, today, go run 5 miles. And I say, I don't want to, but it keeps bugging me all day. And it says, hey, you haven't run yet. Are you going to go run? And so I go do that. And actually, I interrupted my priorities. When you interrupt your priorities, it kind of throws a wrench in things. And yesterday, I let one of my friends talk me into climbing up the incline. And that interrupted my priorities because now my legs are sore and I don't want to run. But you pay for those sort of things. But these are just my fleshly priorities. And we also have to have spiritual priorities. So in Matthew chapter 6, verse 25, and Tracy will put it up there on the screen if you don't want to flip. It says, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, what you will drink, about your body, what you will wear. It is not your life more important than food. Is not your life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? And he continues on and he says, look at the birds of the air. Do they not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than them? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? He continues on. And why do you worry about clothes? So see how the lilies of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall I eat? What shall I drink? What shall I wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. And therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Matthew gives us an idea of where God wants our priorities. Matthew tells us, don't worry about all these things. I'm going to take care of you. Make sure your priorities are on me. And that's what Solomon was doing. He was putting God first. He was putting God first before his own needs, before his own comfort, before his wife's comfort, before his family's comfort. He made sure that he took care of what he needed to take care of. God was his first priority. And so we see Solomon built this magnificent complex that was also included a palace for his wife. And I had to stop right there and think, well, why did Solomon have to build his wife her own palace? And we know, if you know anything about Solomon, he had tons of wives, way too many. He had more than one, so he had way too many. He had tons of wives, but he built a palace for this one wife. I don't know if she was extra naggy, or if, you know, he just didn't want to be around her, or if she was extra needy, or what the case was. Or maybe it was just the fact that she was Pharaoh's daughter, and he felt like, well, she came from royalty, so she deserves a little bit more. And so he built her this palace. And I don't know, maybe they just didn't get along. Who knows? So let's dig into this a little bit deeper. As I read through those first 13 verses, you get that illusion that Solomon spent a lot of time building up his complex, his palace, and all this stuff. But I want to submit to you that the reason that I believe that this chapter is more about priorities and priorities of God than Solomon's priorities is that if you do the math, the verses that deal with Solomon's things and the verses that deal with God's things, God outnumbers Solomon about 3-1. There's only about a quarter of those verses that very quickly describe Solomon's complex that he built, and then all the rest of them talk about how Solomon furnished God's house. So let's go on and read in verse 13. So verse 13 starts out like this. It says, King Solomon sent to Tyre, and he brought Huram, whose mother was a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and whose father was from Tyre, a skilled craftsman in bronze. Huram was filled with wisdom, with understanding, and with knowledge to do all kinds of bronze work. He came to Solomon and did all the work assigned to him. He cast two bronze pillars, each 18 cubits high and 12 cubits in circumference, and he also made two capitals of cast bronze to set on the tops of those pillars. Each capital was 5 cubits high. A network of interwoven chains adorned the capitals on the top of the pillars, and 7 for each capital. He made pomegranates in 2 rows encircling each network to decorate the capitals on the top of the pillars, and he did the same for each capital. The capitals on the top of the pillars in the portico were in the shape of lilies 4 cubits high. On the capitals of both pillars are above the bowl-shaped part next to the network were the 200 pomegranates in rows all around. He erected the pillars at the portico of the temple, and the pillar to the south was named Jachin, and the one to the north was named Boaz. The capitals on the top were the shape of lilies, and so the work of the pillars was completed. And so we see here Solomon brings in this man named Huram. And he brings him in because he is very skilled in working with bronze. And King Solomon's mines had a lot of bronze. So why not use it, right? Why not use it as an ornamental thing for the temple and to make things look beautiful? And so Hiram made these huge pillars. He made these huge pillars that were 18 cubits high. And as Jim, I think last week explained, a cubit is roughly measured from your elbow, right, to your fingertips. And my elbow to my fingertips is a lot different than Tracy's elbow to his fingertips, and is a lot different than Adrian's. He says he's got big ones. He went like this. And Ty is much taller than me. So my guess, and Joe, he's much taller than me. My guess is from his elbow to his fingertips is a lot longer than mine, at least by inches. So at some point they made the cubit a standard measurement of 18 inches, approximately, right? It depends if you do a short cubit or a long cubit. A long cubit is 21 inches. But in most cases, we're talking about the 18-inch cubit. So if you do the math really quickly, and I know you guys all did, because you all are great scholars and great mathematicians, these pillars ended up being 27 feet high. So 27 feet high. Did Mark get it right?
Yes.
Good job, Mark. Tracy, how high are these ceilings? So they're about 24 at the highest. So these pillars were even higher than the highest point in the sanctuary. So these were huge, huge pillars. I can remember when I was in the Army, and here goes the Army reference so I can just get it out of the way. I went through air assault school when I was at a station at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and part of your training is you learn to rappel when you're learning to rappel off 30-foot walls. So you learn to rappel off 30-foot walls. So I can tell you, from being up there and being much higher, being up at 90 feet and higher and rappelling, 27 feet is still a pretty high height. So these things were huge. And he erected them in the portico. How many of you even know what a portico is? It's not a porta potty, all right? It is not the porta potty. It's not the place where they went outside and went to the bathroom. So the portico was actually, you know, you look at some ancient structures and you see these like, maybe a good way to think about it is the Lincoln Monument. You know how there's like that, there's like a porch outside that kind of is covered and there's these pillars, and inside of it there's, you know, the Lincoln Memorial and Lincoln Monument and stuff like that. So a portico was basically a covered porch that was covered by these huge pillars, or that was held up by these huge pillars. And this one had two main pillars, and they were named Jachin and Boaz. So Jachin, actually, and they both had a name for a reason. So you were walking into the entrance to the temple, and you see Jachin, and you see Boaz. Or rather, which way are you facing? So Boaz would be over here, because this is north, right? So Jachin and Boaz. So what Jachin meant was he will establish. And within that, there's actually a little more context that we need to think about. And most scholars believe that it actually meant the reason he called it Jachin is because he wanted people to remember that he, meaning Yahweh, God, the Lord, will establish thy throne forever. Because God had made a promise to Solomon back in 1 Kings chapter 6 that he would uphold the promise that he gave to David back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 11 and 13, where the throne would continue on through the lineage of David. So it was named Jachin for a reason. Hiram was very strategic about that. He said, I'm going to name this one because God has made you a promise. And that promise is that he will establish this throne, the throne of David, forever to rule over Israel and eventually rule over the world when Jesus comes back. And then the other statue that was facing the north, Boaz stands for in the strength. And again, this wasn't just thought to be just a simple in the strength. Scholars believe that Hiram meant it to, in the context of in the strength of Yahweh shall the king rejoice. So what he was trying to say there is Solomon, in the strength of the Lord, you will have a joyful and a joyous life. very skilled man. And he put a lot of work, I'm sure, into these pillars. But his work didn't end there. And we're going to read a little bit more about that. In verse 23, it says, "He," which is talking about Hiram again, "made the sea of cast metal circular in shape, measuring 10 cubits from rim to rim and 5 cubits high, and it took a line of 30 cubits to measure around it. Below the rim, gourds encircled it, 10 to a cubit. The gourds were cast in the two rows and in one piece of the sea. The sea stood on 12 bulls, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. The sea rested on top of them, and their hindquarters were toward the center. It was a handbreadth in thickness, and its rim was like the rim of a cup, like the lily blossom. It held 2,000 baths. He also made 10 movable stands of bronze, each 4 cubits long, 4 wide, and 3 high." And this is how the stands were made. And they had side panels attached to uprights, and on the panels between the uprights were lions, bulls, and cherubim. And on the uprights as well. Above and below the lions and the bulls were wreaths of hammered work. Each stand had 4 bronze wheels with bronze axles, and each had a basin resting on 4 supports, cast with wreaths on each side, and on the inside of the stand there was an opening that had a circular frame, 1 cubit deep. This opening was round, and with the basework, it measured a cubit and a half. Around it, there was an engraving, and the panels and the stands were square, not round. The 4 wheels were under the panels, and the axles and the wheels were attached to the stand, and the diameter of each wheel was a cubit and a half, and the wheels were made like chariot wheels. And the axles, rims, spokes, and hubs were all of cast metal. Each stand had 4 handles on each one, one on each corner, projecting from the stand. At the top of the stand, there was a circular band half a cubit deep, and the support and the panels were attached at the top of the stand. He engraved the cherubim, lions, and palm trees on the surface and of the supports and on the panels in every available space with wreaths all around them. This was the way he made the 10 stands. They were all cast in the same molds and were identical in size and shape. He then made 10 bronze basins, each holding 40 baths and measuring 4 cubits across, 1 basin to go on each of the 10 stands. He placed 5 of the stands on the south side of the temple and 5 on the north, and he placed the sea on the south side and the southeast corner of the temple. And he also made posts and all the pots and shovels and sprinkling bowls. So I read through all that because all that is important. Like I said, inventory is important. All the work that went into this was very important. He was a very skilled man, and he put a lot of work into it. And Solomon sought this man to give the best to the Lord. Solomon sought out this man to come to Israel to build these ornate things for the temple of the Lord. In 2 Chronicles, which is the parallel passage for this chapter, 2 Chronicles 4:6, it tells us that these bowls were actually used, that were described here, were used for cleansing the offerings and the priests. It says that in chapter 4, verse 6 of 2 Chronicles, he then made 10 basins for washing and placed 5 on the south side, 5 on the north. Those are the ones we were just talking about in 1 Kings. And in them, the things to be used for burnt offerings were rinsed, but the sea was used for the priests for washing. So there was definitely a purpose, and there was a reason he made them as big as he did and as many as he did, and all the things that went into it were very important. In verse 25, you may have noticed in 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 25, there was a reference to he made 12 bulls. And if you think back into Israel's history, cows got Israel in trouble before. So why in the world would they put 12 bulls in the temple of the Lord? But there was actually a purpose for this. Scholars believe that they were actually positioned very strategically where they were, facing north, facing west, facing south, and facing east, as a representation of how God is omnipotent. And he is all around us, and he is protecting us from every direction. So these bulls were not set up to be idols. Like, if you go back to the story when they left Egypt and they screwed up and they made a golden calf and they started worshiping it. These bulls were not made for that intention. They were not made for worship. They were made as just a representation of strength and an omnipresent Lord that's covering you and I and them in every direction, in a full 360-degree direction. And then we see also in 2 Chronicles 4, it also talks about the pots and the bowls and the shovels and what they were used for. And then we get to the final inventory that was taken of all the things that Huram made in verse 41, and it says, the two pillars, the two bowl-shaped capitals on top of the pillars, the two sets of network decorating, the two bowls-shaped capitals on top of the pillars, the 400 pomegranates for two sets of networks, two rows of pomegranates for each network, decorating the bowl-shaped capitals on top of the pillars. The 10 stands with the 10 basins, the sea and the 12 bowls under it, the pots and the shovels and the sprinkling bowls. All of these objects that Huram made for King Solomon for the temple of the Lord were on burnished bronze. The king had them cast in clay molds in the plain of Jordan between those two cities. And Solomon left all of these things unweighed because there were so many, the weight of the bronze was not determined. So this was the final inventory. And I can tell you, you know, usually when you go through, when you do an inventory, right, there's always one final count. You have this thing, you know, hey, I'm supposed to have 10 speakers, and you compare those against what your other form says, and you make sure, yep, I had 10 speakers. So that's what we're doing here. We're just getting one last final inventory, making sure we understand all the things that Huram had made for King Solomon that they put into the temple and in all its grandeur. And then in verse 48 through 51, it talks about the things that Solomon also had made. Solomon also made all the furnishings that were in the Lord's temple, the golden altar, the golden table on which they placed the bread, the lampstands of pure gold, 5 on the right and 5 on the left, in the front of the inner sanctuary, the gold floral work and lamps and tongs, the pure golden basins, wick trimmers, sprinkling bowls, dishes, censers, and the golden sockets and the doors, in the innermost room in the most holy place, and then for the doors in the main hall in the temple. When all the work King Solomon had done in the temple of the Lord was finished, he brought in the things that his father David had dedicated, the silver, the gold, and the furnishings, and he placed them in the treasuries of the Lord's temple. So we just read a huge inventory sheet. But in that inventory sheet, there was a definite priority, and the priority was the dedication of the things of the Lord and how they had meaning, and they weren't just things that Solomon had made because he really likes to make cool things, and he likes to make bowls, and maybe he liked pomegranates and gourds and I don't know, all these things. No, those things were made for a purpose, and they had a priority. What is amazing about this whole span of time, so we just spanned 20 years in the matter of a few minutes, was that the nation of Israel, which is a nation of less than 1 million people at this point, was able to endure 20 years of peace. And that is what allowed them, God allowed them 20 years of peace to build the temple, and then to build Solomon's palace and the whole complex and that whole deal and to finish all these things that were going to go into the temple, and 20 years of peace. Now, at that time, if you didn't know, that part of the world wasn't exactly the most peaceful place in the world. I mean, there was nations rising up and down and people conquering people, and all these things were happening, right? And that's actually soon to come down the road in history, as Israel is going to be overtaken by the Babylonians and the Assyrians and all these nations that are much larger than them, that have a much larger fighting force than them. So I find it amazing that over the course of 20 years, nobody came there, nobody attacked them, and they were able to complete these amazing projects that a nation much larger than them would, you would think it was a nation much larger that would have completed this. They simply had less than 1 million people, and they completed this huge economic significance, religious significance, all these things. And so why do we go through this history lesson? Because I made you sit here and listen to it, right? Why do we go through this? Why do we read verse by verse by verse through this inventory? Because on the surface, it looks just like an inventory. But if you decide to dig a little bit deeper down, you see there was definitely priorities. And God had his hand on Solomon, and God had his hand on the nation of Israel because their priorities were right. They set their priorities on God and not the things of this world. It focuses on the loyalty of Solomon and all the people that he employed. Solomon employed the best of the best to build the Lord's temple for 7 years. Solomon employed the best rock cutters, the best carpenters, the best of everything to build the best temple that he could build for the Lord. And then Solomon employed the best man he knew to come in and kind of put the finishing touches on it. Put the finishing touches on the pillars and all the things that were made out of bronze. His priority was to the Lord. Solomon had a beautiful home, and it took a long time to build. And we no longer, I mean, today we don't have this beautiful building and the temple that was invested for the Lord and all that time. And at times we invest our lives in the wrong priority, right? We want to make sure that we have the security of a nice home, and we want to make sure we have the best schooling for our kids, and we want to make sure we have a car that runs because we got to get to work, because if we don't work, then we don't have a house, and we don't have food, and we don't have all these things. But what did Matthew tell us? Matthew told us, do not worry about any of that stuff. God takes care of the lilies in the field. God takes care of the birds of the air, and they do nothing. They do nothing for the kingdom except for display God's beauty and God's miracles that he created them. Other than that, the birds ain't doing much, and the lilies ain't doing much except for looking pretty. Okay? But God takes care of all them. So we need to make sure we have our priorities right. And if you read in Ecclesiastes, which was written by David's son Solomon, you see Solomon came to that conclusion towards the end of his life. And it says, these are the words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Solomon has priorities right here, but there will come a time when Solomon doesn't have his priorities right. And we all can fall into that trap. We can all fall into that cycle. We got our priorities right, we stumble. We got our priorities right, we stumble. We got our priorities right, we stumble. If we're not focused on the right priority. When we lose focus on the priority of God, he's going to take care of us. And in the end, even if we're Bill Gates, or even if we're whoever, and we have tons of things, and tons of cars, and tons of houses, and a boat, and an island in the Pacific, and whatever, we have all this stuff, it's going to be meaningless if our priorities aren't right. It's going to be meaningless. We're going to take an inventory of our life, And we're going to say, none of that stuff mattered. But you know what does matter when you have your priorities right? Is the things, the heavenly things. The things that will count after you're gone. The legacy that you leave behind. The people that you helped bring into the kingdom. All these things, those are the things that are going to matter when you have your priorities right. Having your priorities on the things of this world, in the end, is just going to give you nothing but meaningless thoughts. Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. So don't let your efforts be focused on the things of this world. God has set before each and every one of us a task and a purpose and a reason for being here and a reason for being wherever we are tomorrow and a reason for wherever we're going to end up being a year from now. All I say to you is take an inventory of what you are about to invest in that. Take an inventory of what really matters. Not your house, not your car, not any of those things. Take an inventory of the things that matter. Take an inventory of the things that you're doing for God. Take an inventory of the things that He has asked you to do, and then do them. Make your priority God, and then everything else. Okay? And I know it's hard. We're all human. We're all sinful. We're all fallen. And the world gets in our way, and we just got to refocus. Make your priority God, and then everything else will fall in line. God will take care of you just the way He takes care of the birds of the air and the lilies in the field. Will you pray with me? Father, I thank You for this time. We thank You for this lesson. We thank You for Your words. And we thank You for the opportunity to be here in a place that is safe, that we can sit here and we can think and we can talk and we can ponder and we can be with our brothers and sisters in Christ without fear. Father, I just want to pray for our brothers and sisters all across the world who right now do not have that same freedom and are living in fear, not of You, but in fear of what may happen just by following You. And I pray that You would give them boldness and bravery and all the things that they need to do the job that You have set before them wherever they are. Father, I pray for my brothers and sisters as they get ready to depart from here. I pray that they would take to heart the sign as they drive out that driveway that says, "Your mission field starts now." Father, I pray that You would give them a priority in their heart to do the things that You have called them to do, and that they would have the boldness to follow through on those things. And it's in Your name we pray. Amen. Why are you trying to earn grace? Why are you crying? Let me lift up your face. Just don't turn away.